Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Yes, we begin with, of course, Colonel Vindman and his powerful testimony before the impeachment hearing of 2019. So many things to keep in your head as you vote in November. Remember Wisconsin, remember Vindman, pray for the facts, and vote with your conscience. Now, Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
If it's Friday, it must be Scott Braddock, the editor of the Quorum Report, the voice of Texas, the dean of the Austin Press Corps. And I have to tell you, Scott, I was going to start with a story about baseball, but just before you come on, we taped a show, everyone, on Thursday morning to be aired on Friday. You said, I've got breaking news. So I will tell my baseball story in the second interview, not now. But tell me, what's going on?
This coronavirus pandemic is affecting people in ways that it just hits you from all angles, right? You have no idea what's coming next. And we're reporting this morning, on Thursday morning as we tape, out of Fort Bend County, which is in the Houston area. That's a suburb of Houston to the southwest. Mm-hmm. It's near where I grew up. And it is home to one of the large prisons in Texas. And we're told that the county judge there, and of course, the county judge in Texas, that's the administrator for the county, is expected to make an announcement this morning that basically the community there was blindsided, Arnie, because the Texas Department of Criminal Justice notified them last Friday that the agency was going to start moving prisoners from around the state at all the other large facilities that are prisons in the state to Richmond, Texas, which is in Fort Bend County. They're moving the prisoners who have coronavirus to Fort Bend County. Hundreds of them coming into the prison there. And this is very concerning for the locals who, number one, were not told anything about it. They just said, hey, this is about to happen. And it's very concerning for the local population because of the people who work at the prison and live there in the community who got no heads up about this. And the local officials are said to be very upset with the state. They say that when they ask the state exactly what the protocols are going to be for how they're going to try to keep people safe in the community because people work there and live there, they got a lackluster response. Apparently they told them that they would be checking people's temperatures and they have gloves and masks and stuff like that, but they're going to be interacting one-on-one with folks who have COVID-19 from all over Texas, who, by the way, have been in our prison system, which is, not the most pristine system in the world. Of course, the Texas prisons are even worse than some of those around the rest of the country. So this is a developing story. We'll see what the state has to say about it. But these folks there in Fort Bend County just feeling really blindsided today.
Well, not only have they been slammed, but I have a couple of questions. I don't know, obviously, this is so early in the story, you may not be able to answer them, but maybe we'll get to those answers next week. And that is that have they drained some of the population out of that prison so that there are available beds? Have they drained all the healthy people out of that prison and only left the COVID-19 patients there? It just sounds like it's becoming a COVID ward, but a COVID ward that's not going to be assigned to hospital workers, it's going to be assigned to prison workers. Prison workers aren't trained to deal with this kind of a pandemic. They're not trained in healthcare. They're not given the same kind of things. And I know people, you and I both know, nurses and doctors that don't go home anymore. Okay? They go to hotels.
Right.
They sleep in their car. So my question is, what are you going to do with the prison workers? Because if they go home and they don't have the same kind of PPEs that hospital workers have, they're going to go home contaminated. They're not just going to affect their families. They're right. going to affect everyone in the community. And what kind of healthcare system is available within that community to deal with this incredible concentration?
Sounds like it's been put together in a slapdash fashion. We will get try to get some of the answers to those questions, but it doesn't sound like it's been completely thought out, other than the state probably moving to try to consolidate where all these folks are. But as you said, you could probably describe it as the coronavirus recovery ward yes. for the Texas prison system exactly. at this point. And it may be as many as about 400 people, prisoners who have coronavirus. Now, there are other places that these folks will be if they're in intensive care.
Right.
But this is where those who are not in intensive right. care are being taken. That's what we were told. And the process actually started last Friday. They were notified of it on the same day that it actually got started as they started to truck these people down to Fort Bend.
So, you know, we had a really interesting conversation yesterday with a woman who writes for the New York Times, and she wrote a story about Chelsea, Massachusetts. And I want to connect these stories because I think they're important for you to hear. Chelsea, very poor immigrant population. There's an incredible density. There's no way for them to social distance. People are sleeping on porches. People are sleeping in closets. And they're also terrified because there are a lot of undocumented immigrants that live in this community. Okay, but they see a huge hotspot of COVID-19. So what they wanted to do is once they tested these people, they didn't want them to go back to this very dense population that they were living in at home. They wanted them to go to hotels. And they literally had warehouse. They didn't warehouse. They bought out all these hotel rooms and said, please, please, please don't go home. Go to these hotels. We'll give you 3 squares a day. Stay there for 14 days until you test negatively, and then you can go home. Well, it was a brilliant idea. Only 14 people went.
Oh.
Only four, because they were terrified. They mm-hmm. maybe trust people at home. But of course, when you're COVID positive, nobody wants to trust you. And I think there's also a fear because some of them might be undocumented, even though that question won't be asked, will ICE then go and raid them? And will they become more vulnerable? But as she was describing the situation for them in Chelsea, mm-hmm. all I kept thinking was, this is what it's like being in a prison. You can't socially isolate. Everyone is getting contaminated. Everyone mm-hmm. fears you. Nobody has the appropriate PPEs. The only thing these people don't have is they don't have locks on their doors.
Right.
And that's why what you're describing is just such an incredible tragedy, because it ain't a hospital. And you tell me that they're going to assign the kind of PPEs you see in a hospital to every prison worker who doesn't even know how to use those PPEs. Let's even be honest here. A lot of them have to be trained to use them. So it's a mess.
Yeah. And, you know, we'll see what the fallout is here. And I do expect the county judge there to be particularly outspoken. And by the way, that's a part of the state where the politics have changed, Arnie. This is, a Democratic county judge in what has right. long been a Republican area. And meantime, up in a different part of the state, actually a different part of the same region, to the north of Houston, Montgomery County, Texas, you have the county judge there who's a rock solid Republican, a Tea Party style Republican, who has said that on Friday, even though Governor Abbott has talked about, a sort of a slow moving reopening
right.
of the state mm-hmm. of Texas, which some people think it's too fast, some people think it's too slow. The county judge in Montgomery County thinks it's too slow. And he says that what the governor laid out earlier this week, which we'll talk more about, but that he feels that the governor's moving too slow and has been too vague in the way he's laid out his orders. And so in Montgomery County, Texas, where about 600,000 people live, the county judge says that he's not going to enforce this idea that hair salons and gyms and other businesses have to remain closed as of Friday. He says that restaurants and movie theaters can go ahead and open on Friday at full capacity. He's also said that if the governor doesn't clarify his orders before Friday, and we're taping here on Thursday, then he's going to go ahead and allow everything to open up. This, of course, was met with just sort of slack-jawed people around the state saying, what in the world is going on there? This is the kind of leadership that's been elected in that county. And by the way, it's the last of the big Republican suburban counties in Texas. And so I'm wondering if this is going to be the petri dish for what happens here in Texas. County judge there is telling everybody, for just with the coronavirus, if the county judge there is telling everybody it's okay go on out. And he posted to Facebook a video to this effect. Go out and go to your favorite restaurant, go to the businesses that you want to go to, get out of your house because the stay at home order has been lifted by the governor. These messages from leaders, Arnie, have to be very clear. And they don't need mixed messages. People don't need mixed messages, right? When you're talking about something that's of such importance, when you're talking about people's lives and their livelihoods, and you have people who are desperate to go back to work, and so they're going to want to do that. I wonder if what we're going to see in Montgomery County on Friday sets the tone for what happens in a lot of other places, because if people in other parts of the state see that those folks there just north of Houston are going out, going to restaurants, living their lives like they were before the coronavirus, then, I wonder if other people are going to be tempted to do the same thing. And who's going to enforce it if they decide they do want to go out?
Okay, so a couple of things are going through my head. Because you also pointed out, and you said we're going to bring this back up, and this is in a totally appropriate time. You said at the political riskiest moment of the pandemic so far, yeah. Governor Abbott assumes all responsibility for the path forward. Now, I want to mirror that statement that you sent me with what you just told me about this county judge.
Yeah.
And that is that in a way, he's kind of blaming Abbott, even as he's kind of listening to Abbott, because he talks about the fact that you are too vague, Abbott. While you have basically taken on this responsibility, it is almost void for vagueness because you're not really giving me clear direction. And so what he's kind of forcing Abbott to do is either to really nail stuff down so he thinks he's been given guidance, or Abbott will punt. And that will then give him the opportunity to open up his county, because obviously what Abbott has done has not been specific. But you know what this reminds me of, Scott? We have, coming out of the Trump administration, all these things about, you know, how we go from one point to another, 14 days of, you know, less hospitalizations, of fewer deaths, of more testing, of more this. Not one state has met that standard. That was set by Trump, okay? Mm-hmm. Trump forgets it after he sets it. And then all the states from Georgia and whatever start opening up. So I think what's really frightening here is that this is kind of the Wild West, literally. And that whatever you want to do, you do. And whatever you think you need to hear, you hear. And you cherry pick. And you cherry pick based on your politics. You cherry pick based on your location. And in the end, the people who are getting cherry picked are the people who are going to end up dead.
Yeah, it's nothing like when the emergency response would be handled ahead of a hurricane, for example, when there are some complexities to that, of course. But I was thinking about the question of whether people should evacuate Houston or not.
Yes,
when there was a hurricane in 2005 that was pointed at Houston, Hurricane Rita, and the question was whether people were going to have to leave and either head north or head west on I-45 or on I-10. And that's just a binary thing. Do you leave or not? And, you know, the question was left to the county judges, because that's the way that the state is set up. At the local level, the county judges are empowered to handle emergency management. 3 million people did leave, did evacuate, and the evacuation itself turned deadly when there were cars backed up from Galveston all the way to Dallas-Fort Worth, which on a normal day is a 7-hour drive. Mm-hmm. In fact, there was a bus that exploded just south of Dallas. It killed a bunch of elderly folks in that situation because they were sitting there and the oxygen tanks exploded. It was a terrible tragedy. But who knows how many people would have died if people would have stayed in Houston and then the hurricane had hit the city. In this coronavirus situation, these complex guidelines and plans are being laid out for people. It's very complicated. And so the way that leadership talks about it has to be clear and crisp so that people understand what's expected of them, what they're supposed to be doing. The reason I said that Governor Abbott has assumed all responsibility here is because he's once again testing the limits of the powers of his office. When he authored his executive orders this week, he issued three of them. Mm-hmm. And in one of them, he did something that a lot of folks' eyebrows went up and they said, can he do that? In one of them, he said he was suspending certain parts of state law. And the parts of the state law that he said he was suspending have to do with empowering mayors and county judges to be able to do things that suppress disease. In other words, he's undercutting the local officials and saying, you don't have the power to do that anymore. I'm suspending the state law that allows you to do that. And I'm taking on the responsibility of handling the state's response to COVID-19. Now, there's a few issues with this. I heard from some Republican lawmakers who said that they were very concerned that the governor was pushing the constitutional limits of his office. Seems like he's going a little far with this, although he has done similar things before. He's done similar things before, although it was in more benign situations. For example, if you look up Congressman Blake Farenthold, you may remember him. He was from Corpus Christi, and he had some scandals. He was caught up in the Me Too movement, and he had to resign. Well, when they chose a replacement, when there was an election to replace him, the governor suspended the law to change the election date because he wanted it to be on a certain date without going into the weeds of all that. He had suspended state law. And then last year, he had suspended the law reconstituted a state agency that the legislature had failed to extend, the plumbing board here in Texas. Mm-hmm. These things were
on the margins.
Well, they were on the margins outcomes that most people agreed with. It was the outcome that people were okay with.
Right.
And they didn't really get into the process of it. It didn't care as much. There were some people who said, well, you know, the governor is just trying to do the right thing here. So we're not going to, you know, raise hackles about this. But now, once again, testing the limits of his office and saying that he's going to suspend state law so that he can have all the power as far as responding to COVID-19. It really takes it takes the ball out of the court of the local officials. The mayor of Houston, Sylvester Turner, on the same day that Abbott made the announcement that we were going to be reopening Texas, and he was assuming the responsibility for it. Mayor of Houston held a press conference about an hour later and said, look, it's out of our hands. Now, if you're one of those mayors or county judges who doesn't want to suffer political consequences for this, the governor probably did you a favor, right? He probably set it up such that, hey, you can't be blamed because the governor has said, you know, everything I'm doing supersedes what anybody would do at the local level. You do have the county judge in Dallas, a guy named Clay Jenkins, who I'm sure you've seen many times on CNN at this point. Clay Jenkins was saying that the governor is wrong, that we don't need to open as fast and people still need to wear the face coverings, which the governor did not mandate in his order. I think Jenkins is maybe setting himself up to run against Abbott at some point. He seems like somebody who wants to be on the ticket. But the county judge in Houston, for example, who had just put an order in on Monday, that said, had issued an order that said that people had to wear face masks. She was undercut by Abbott on the same day when he said that people don't have to wear the face masks. And so when the lieutenant governor, the governor, and the speaker of the House are not wearing masks in their press conference, by the way, and they say that masks are encouraged but not mandated, I can tell you what Texans are going to do with that. A lot of them are just not going to wear them. And of course, they don't have to now because of the way that the governor set that up. Meantime, you have people like the lieutenant governor saying the masks are encouraged, but saying that they're not required. And then you have local officials saying that people need to wear those masks. And the whole mask thing, Arnie, has really become sort of a stand up and be counted moment. It's the kind of politics, it's another level of politics, right? When you tell people they have to physically do something that everybody in their neighborhood can see, everybody knows where you are on that issue. There's nowhere to hide, right? I mean, they can either see that you have the mask or not. Do you agree with the people who say you have to wear the mask, or do you agree with freedom, as some of these folks would, which is ridiculous, but some of these people would frame it up that way.
No, but there's another way of framing it, Scott. Let me just tell you something. So I am looking at our grocery store in the big grocery store chain in New Hampshire. It's called Market Basket. And Market Basket, you know, they put up the plastic. Okay, they've done that. They've got somebody that's wiping off the handles. But when I was at Market Basket the other day, nobody, none of the checkout people wearing masks, maybe one, none of the baggers were wearing masks or whatever. And so I said, this is insane. Because if you start reading more and more and more, the one place where the community spread actually happens, it happens in grocery stores. And therefore, because so many people have to go there, because those people that are working on the line see and are exposed to so many people, in order to protect those workers, they should be wearing masks, okay? In order to protect me, I should be wearing a mask to protect them, okay? So then someone said, oh, Arnie, just go shop at the Hanover Co-op or the Concord Co-op, because at my co-op, everybody's wearing a mask. All the personnel are wearing masks. We know how to be safe. So I said, here we go, privilege again. So because we don't have a state standard, just a recommendation, Those that serve the 90% are not insisting that their personnel wear masks or that people that go there wear masks, but people that live in the little sort of wealthy enclaves. Guess what, Scott? Everybody that's near there wears a mask. And what does that tell you? It's a story of who's expendable. It's a story of privilege. It's a story. I mean, and what kills me is at Market Basket, this one grocery store chain, you know what the baggers have to wear? They have to wear ties.
Oh.
So they're ordered by their company to wear ties. They're just not ordered by their company to save lives. I just want everyone to understand that. So I said, I have an idea. Let's call the face mask a tie for the face.
I mean, well, this has really shined the light on a lot of the inequality in the country.
Yes.
A lot of the inequities where you have those underserved and underprivileged folks who just can't afford. I mean, forget the mask for a second. There's a lot of people who are out of work, they can't work from home like you and I do. A lot of people, exactly. At least not doing what they used to do. They maybe have to find a different profession if they want to work right now. There are plenty of job openings in Texas at this moment, but not at the places where people have become accustomed to working. And so there are a lot of folks who are just suffering. In South Dallas County, for example, you have the Democratic County Commissioner there who's sort of a legend in North Texas politics, a guy named John Wiley Price, who's been around for a long time, who was fighting with the county judge who wanted to have more restrictions on which people could go to work and which businesses could be open. And they're both Democrats. So this other Democrat, the African-American, was saying that, look, that's not going to work for my people. My people need to be able to go to work at this place and this place and this place. He's like, I don't necessarily like the way that the payday lenders operate, but that's their financial institution for a lot of people in my neighborhoods. They need to be able to go to those places or go to the pawn shop because that's their reality. That's how they live paycheck to almost paycheck in some of these places. And so those who live in poverty, those who don't have access to healthcare the way that a lot of us do, those who don't have good health insurance and all of that, it's all been just exacerbated. These are problems that already existed.
Right.
And it just makes it that much worse.
Well, and then you've got, I don't know how many facilities exist in Texas, but we're seeing the facilities for Smithfield and Tyson Foods and what's happening there. And they're shutting down, but now they're being ordered back open because Donald Trump is demanding that they're essential workers. And what is really fascinating about this essential worker concept is that does an essential worker mean that if you reopen your facility and you hide behind the shield of being told, well, we're being told we're essential workers, does that then limit your liability because you haven't provided the kind of safety situation for your workers? Therefore, I don't have to maybe provide all the PPEs and all the distancing and all that kind of stuff. I mean, there are so many issues going on here. And again, what will be fascinating about the governor is how is he going to respond? Will he be more specific by Friday, which the show will air on Friday? Or do you think he'll still be, take the responsibility, but still be somewhat elastic in its interpretation? Therefore, you can interpret it where you can open up everything, or you can interpret it that you basically can have this slope to opening.
Yeah, this is the difficult part of this. And by the way, it's not my argument that he hasn't been specific enough. I mean, I think his orders are fairly detailed. But again, the issue is, I think, in trying to communicate this to 29 million Texans is what exactly are you supposed to do? When the governor laid out his executive orders, he said that restaurants are allowed to open, any restaurants allowed to open, but their occupancy has to be capped at 25%. Well, who is going to enforce that all over a state of 254 counties and two time zones? Right. And this is a big business tailored plan, as we previewed for our listeners last week, Arnie. I heard from restaurant owners all over the state, from Dallas-Fort Worth to Houston to far west Texas, El Paso, and little places like Marathon out in the Big Bend region. Mm-hmm. People who said, look, if I've got 10 tables in a restaurant, I can't open at 25% capacity because I can't make any money. When people are trying to make money in the restaurant business, they operate on such thin margins that it's not, and this is the way my publisher put it the other day. He said, when you're in that kind of business, there's no profit in the first dollar that you get. The profit's in the last dollar. And so when you have people coming in you can only have four tables that are open, you can't pay your employees. You can't kind of profit for yourself, and you can't keep operating. So a lot of them were simply saying they're not even going to try to open. The governor had also said, that movie theaters could open. Well, for one thing, they're not showing any new movies. The big studios are not doing releases right now to theaters. So what movies are they even going to show?
Right.
Alamo Drafthouse, which is based here in Austin and has, you know, is a chain across the country. They put out what I thought was a pretty responsible statement after the governor had said that the movie theaters could open. They said, we're not going to do it. And other theaters had said they were not going to open either. Alamo Drafthouse had tweeted out from their corporate account that they wanted to keep their employees safe and the people who, you know, their patrons safe. And so there was they were going to have to undertake some pretty complicated measures to try to do social distancing in a theater. I mean, think about it, Arnie, at a time like this, do you really want to go pack into a theater with 100 other people with recycled air and everybody's, you know, jammed right next to each other
and
while they're serving popcorn and drinks?
Right,
I don't think so.
And if you sneeze in the air, you know that it stays in the air for a couple of hours, let alone a couple of minutes. And when someone sneezes, it doesn't just go 6 feet. It can go almost as far as like 30 feet. So again, it's all these things. And are they going to make them wear masks when they come into the movie theater? How do you eat the popcorn and drink the big gulp when you're there? As I'm listening to you, I just want to remind everyone, I used to work in the restaurant business. And I'll tell you what it's about. It's about how many turns you have. It's not only about tables, but you want people in and out and
move them out.
So every restaurant owner is going, they're doing the math on the back of an envelope. And they're going, there is no way I am opening. I can't even afford to order food. Maybe I could serve two items. That's it, you know, given what they're doing. And when they begin to look at that, it is not worth the cost. And frankly, you actually save more money by not opening than creating all the liability issues and all the employment issues if you do.
Yeah, and one other thing we should say about this, the Lieutenant Governor of Texas on a teletown hall this week said that one of his top priorities, if not his top priority, was limiting liability for businesses as they open amid this pandemic, which to a lot of people sounded, Arnie, like, and that reflects what Mitch McConnell had said on the floor about how, you know, the next tranche of aid for coronavirus is going to have to include something to limit liability for businesses. But that also seems to be an acknowledgement that bad things are going to happen as they open their businesses up and they're trying to, you know, keep them from being sued.
So I want to just talk one more thing and then I got to let you go. And that the idea of limited liability, I understand it. The bad things are going to happen, but this cannot be a get out of jail card free, which means that then is the excuse not to provide the PPEs, not to provide the social distancing, not to provide the hand washing. And that's my fear. My fear is that it not only means that people are expendable, but it gets them off the hook for being responsible in order to protect their workers, which means we will see people, they are fodder. They are expendable. I want people to understand it's not about liability. It's about your dying. And that's what it is. And unless they create a really high standard for these employers that they have to meet before they get that liability issue addressed, then guess what? We are totally screwed as a society. I love you, Scott Braddock. I can't wait for next week. There'll be so many interesting details because this show will air on Friday and we'll see what actually happens in Texas with the governor taking on this quote unquote responsibility.
Yeah.
Now the question is, what will the consequences be of that responsibility?
Absolutely. I look forward to talking to you, Arnie. Thank you.
All right, ciao. Scott Braddock, editor of The Quorum Report. Stick around for Current Cast and we'll be right back. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Stephanie Collins and Dave Scott.
Technology goes out on a limb for clean water on this Current Cast. Trees slow, absorb, and purify rainfall. That helps decrease runoff and stormwater pollution. Now, a software tool called iTree Hydro helps city and regional planners measure the exact water benefits of tree cover versus impervious services in their community. Ted Andreni of the State University of New York College of Environmental Science and Forestry says by simulating the impacts of adding more trees,
the model will illustrate reduction in the total volume of stormwater, the slowing of the peak stormwater, and a reduction in the total amount of pollutants in the stormwater.
This provides information that communities can use to better protect their local waters. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell University's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Don't want to work away, doing just what they all say.
Work hard, boy, you'll find one day you'll have a job like mine. 'Cause I know for sure nobody should be that poor. Say yes, sink low, because you happen to say so, say so, you say so. I don't want to work away, doing just what they all say. Work hard, boy, you'll find one day you'll have a job like mine, job like mine, a job like mine. Be wise, look ahead, use your eyes, he said. Be straight, think right, but I might die tonight. Welcome
back to part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We have Bill Curry on the line. Actually, he's on my phone, which is in front of the microphone because we're Zooming. And well, anyway, this is the brave new world of radio in 2020 with the pandemic. And Bill Curry ran for governor of Connecticut twice. He was an advisor to Bill Clinton. He's written for Salon.com. He's worked within the Freeze movement. And he's just a very thoughtful human being. But Bill, before I let you be thoughtful on the air, I wanted to share what is sort of a good news story, because I think everything we've been talking about in the last couple of weeks have been so bleak. And it was a story that I saw coming out of the ArizonaSports.com, and it's been played everywhere else. It was an AP story. Major League Baseball exploring 10-team divisions to resume season this summer. So I saw that and I'm like, huh. And I'm sure there's not going to be full stadiums. We'll probably all be watching it on television. But I thought, well, this is interesting. Will they be able to pull this off? So can I tell you how I framed it on Facebook, this story? This is what I wrote. You're going to love it because it combines politics and baseball. I have a story to share about baseball. Yes, me, who has only been to one game in her entire life. It was 1995, and I'm sitting at my dining room table in Orford, New Hampshire, listening to the radio and writing some policy papers for my race for Congress. The show that happened to be on the radio was talking about baseball, and I was, how shall I say, not exactly tuned in. All of a sudden, the host asked the guest, "So why do you think Americans are so passionate about baseball?" There was this pregnant pause, and then the guest said, "Because baseball is the place where we practice hope. We hope our team will win. We hope that pitcher will strike out the batter. We hope that outfielder will catch that fly ball. We hope and pray that the guy on second base will steal to third. Yep, baseball is the place where we practice hope." I put down my pen and suddenly realized that that's why I do politics. Because for me, politics is the place where I practice hope. So, gang, to echo that sports guy on the radio back in 1995, I truly hope they play ball this summer. We all need a place to practice hope. Anyway, that's my emotional story, Bill Curry, about that. Can I share something with you? So this is 1995 and I'm running, and it's 1996 and I'm being interviewed by a conservative radio talk show host. And he asked me, he said to me, "Why the hell do you like this politics stuff, Arnie?" So I told him that story that I just wrote about, right? And my staff heard me telling that story on the air. So you know what they did? This is so wicked cool, everyone. They literally clipped that interview as I was delivering it to the talk show host. And then they made it into an ad. And what they did was they had the sound of the organ music. And they had the sound of hitting a ball. And the crowds cheering. And that was playing in the background as you heard me answer the question, why do I do politics, and tell the story of baseball. And this is the best part. Never in the history of these two radio stations in northern New Hampshire had people called up and said to the owners of the station, Will you play that baseball ad again? That's how emotional it was. It connected on so many levels. And that why, when I saw that story about baseball, all of a sudden that came roaring back into my head. And I just wanted people to know it is about the need to practice hope. So thank you for joining us, Bill Curry.
Well, we're getting lessons in it today, that's for sure.
Yeah, we are. So let's talk a little bit about the most provocative topic that the Democrats are facing right now. And I sent you three headlines this morning, and the headlines were the following. Tara Reid allegations rattle Biden's vice presidential search. Here's another headline. Democratic frustration mounts as Biden remains silent on sexual assault allegations. And then the last one was from, I believe, Slate.com, and it was entitled, Here's How Not to Publish Your Opinions About Joe Biden and Tara Reid. I am exhausted. I'm exhausted by this campaign. I'm exhausted by Donald Trump. I'm exhausted by the pandemic. But then to have this story of Tara Reid blowing up as we're trying to sort of move forward. And I've already tried to sort of come to terms with the Hunter Biden stuff from last year. And now I have this story. Bill Curry, is there a GPS for this? Where do we go with this? I mean, I've had more people call me. I have more people scream at me on the air. I've had people who are about to be interviewed by the Christian Science Monitor call me up and say, what do I tell the monitor? What do I tell the monitor? And I feel like there's no safe harbor.
Well, there isn't. I think you're entirely right about that. And I am, as everyone I speak to seems to be, of two minds about this. And let me separate them out. The first is I'm not persuaded by the allegations. Number one, but number two, the whole history of such allegations distills to the following point. Almost all the time, what the women say it turns out to be true. and I just, you know, it sounds like a sweeping statement, but I think it is. I think it's a fair statement. It doesn't mean that there haven't been women who have unfairly and dishonestly made charges of this kind, and there are people who make men and women make dishonest or unfair charges about things all the time in this life. Sad to say, and this isn't an exception. But to that rule, so you're sort of caught here at the beginning. What do I know about Joe Biden? I work in Washington. With the nuclear freeze movement in the White House, with an international affairs center. I did many periods in Washington in which I interact with people in the Senate, and you get to know people's reputations in Washington. Washington's favorite rumor, mm-hmm. its most popular rumor, is of men abusing women for obvious reasons.
Oh, God.
And I never heard it about Joe Biden. All you ever heard about Joe Biden was that he took the train every night to Wilmington, Delaware, to put his kids to bed.
Yeah.
And that reputation was so pervasive. And I could name many senators who had the opposite reputation.
Right.
And so it just in those periods, that wasn't something you ever heard about. There are things about the accuser that give me pause. I don't want to be I don't want to participate in the cliche of shaming the accuser or discrediting the accuser. Everybody has minor character and personality flaws. This isn't the best time to be dredging them up. But it also, in fairness, you know, in the end, I'm the kind of civil libertarian who believes deeply in the presumption of innocence until guilt is proven. And in politics, however, you have to make these decisions in real time. You don't actually get to, you know, it's not quite like a trial in that way, because the court of public opinion especially within the limited time frame of an election, has to make a judgment. And I would just say that there are things about this. Of all the worst monsters of Hollywood, Wall Street, and Washington, I've never heard an allegation of someone doing something so utterly egregious in a public hallway. I've never heard anything like this about Biden. I'm puzzled that this allegation wasn't made all at once. God, if it's true, I wish she'd said it all at once when we still had time to act on it. Which we technically do right now, by the way, but we're fast running out of that time. And so I come down to this just thinking that I'm not ready to say that this happened or that it disqualifies Biden, but I am ready to say that he has to make much more of an answer than he has.
But he's
virtually no answer at all.
Right. But let me stop you for really quickly, because I feel like that is exactly how he responded to the Hunter Biden allegations. He was not really forthcoming. He didn't really explain. He basically said, Obama had a set of ethics rules, and this complied with Obama's ethics rules. Well, I'm just going to remind everyone, I don't need a rule to know when something is wrong. Okay? I don't need a law to tell me when something
And none of us should.
Yeah.
To me, the Hunter Biden stuff, the fact that he let it go on, I understand that people do things for their children they wouldn't otherwise do. I've also watched politicians go to jail for things they did for their children. And I would just say that, you know, again, that the Hunter Biden episode was enough for me as part of a larger pattern in the manner of the Clintons and other leaders of my Democratic Party, far too great a comfort level with the with the kind of soft corruption of pay-to-play politics. And I didn't see Hunter Biden as so much of an exception to this,
yeah,
by the way.
Exactly.
I get that the whole crowd does this. Shame on the Democratic Party. Shame on the party that it has put this kind of cronyism that it has allowed such kind of cronyism to fester in its top ranks.
Yeah, but let me just say something.
But having said that, no, I didn't think that was, I didn't think it was a disqualification for the presidency. I just thought it was a good enough reason, although I had others, for me not to vote for Biden in the primary, which I wasn't planning on doing.
All right, let me just stop you there, because I do want to go back to Hunter, because I had to turn myself inside out on that one, and I couldn't. And the reason I couldn't is because Hunter Biden's partner in his firm was John Kerry's stepson. And they dissolved the partnership because John Kerry's stepson, a Hines, was so appalled by Hunter's decision to do this. And then John Kerry, early on, even before Jim Clyburn, comes out and endorses Joe Biden. And I don't remember really hearing anyone confronting Kerry about what his stepson had done. And why did his stepson have the wherewithal and the ethical compass and the moral compass to understand that that was wrong? And how did John Kerry basically wink and nod? And I mean, I just feel like, what do we stand for?
I'm not sure what John Kerry did. That son got out.
Yes.
You know, Kerry's son got out. Biden's son was a drug addict. With a very difficult life.
Yeah.
Listen, I'm not making their brief here, and I actually don't feel the need to parse it at this level.
Yeah.
So Joe Biden announced his campaign for president, and went directly to a closed door meeting with representatives of the telecommunications industry, as I recall, in particular. He has been a big donor Democrat. You know, he started out in Scranton, but he quickly joined the elite at a young age. Mm-hmm. And his responsiveness to money politics throughout his career is a great mark against him. Does he also have a decent heart? Is there also a difference between him and Donald Trump wider than the Mississippi? You bet there is on both counts.
Right.
You know, so I get the situation we're in, and I would just say this again: it 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 grieves me that this Ms. Reed is making this allegation so many months after the first allegation, with so little time here to deal with. I am of necessity more concerned with ridding the country of a fascist president. It's to save the species, the democracy, the American middle class, and America itself. We are all to be pardoned for having these considerations hard on our minds as we judge this.
So let me judge
what to do with it. Having said that, I do believe that Biden has not met a fundamental test of transparency. And I'll say one thing to what you just said about how he handled Hunter Biden, how he handles all of this stuff. Whenever a voter comes up to him at a rally and says something he doesn't like, he bites their head off.
I know.
The fact that he was still crowding women's personal space decades after every male candidate in America got the memo to stop doing that suggests that some of the narcissism of a life spent in high public office has infected his otherwise fine character. and I don't know how much, because I don't know him personally. I've met him only a couple of times over the years, and a few times. And so I would just say, we have a chance here to do this right. And as with all scandal of all kinds, real and alleged, the greatest mistake is always not to come clean.
Yeah.
And there is if we all claim to have learned that lesson, and so let's act as if we had. I don't accept the allegations at face value for a variety of reasons. Things about them seem out of joint to me. But that's also often true of allegations, you know? Mm-hmm. And so we need to see from Biden. I won't be willing to convict him on a 27-year-old incident that is otherwise not well corroborated. And I still think that's true of this. But there's enough corroboration to shift this. This is different than it was 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, exactly.
And so decent people just have to admit that. And that means, one, going back to his damn papers in Delaware, if there's anything in the records of that Senate office that speak to this issue, people have a right to know it. Mm-hmm. And he has to make a response to this. I don't know what his response would be. And I get that it's one of the hardest things in the world is to prove a negative. How do you prove you didn't do something? It's always a tough position to be in. I get that, too. But there's not enough here. And I would just say two things. People, you know, I get that Trump has been accused credibly by scores of credible accusers of deeds this bad and worse. Doesn't matter.
Exactly.
That's, you know, his people will put up with that. Decent people, the vast majority of some of his people are decent people. A number of them are quite deplorable, various clanners and others who are at the core of his constituency. But decent Republicans, Democrats, and independents alike want to set a higher standard. And we want to set a higher standard. And we still have time. We still have time. If this is real and if this is a problem and if Biden does not handle it, we have a time to have a convention choose another candidate. Last point to my Bernie brethren. It won't be a progressive. It won't be Bernie or Warren. If, you know, just everybody understand that if it's not going to be Biden, it's going to be someone else whom the Biden delegates who won these primaries, regardless of any misfeasance by the DNC. Biden won these primaries for sure, and by wide margins. And so that convention's going to come up. It's not going to pick my first choice, nor should it. I mean, that would set a rupture to the party as deep as any. So we should just make sure that this isn't about getting our person in. We'll be in a much more difficult situation than that. And it's not enough to say, as I emphatically do, that he's a better person than Trump. Or to say, as I have on your show, that a mediocre Democrat could be the person who ushers in a time of vast progressive change if we win the White House and the Senate post-Bernie changing America's political discourse, post the pandemic changing America's political discourse, in the age of a rising progressive movement.
So,
and with all these items queued up on this agenda for action to strengthen social safety net, healthcare, income inequality, political corruption, climate change, we have so much on the line.
So let me.
And so much that can be accomplished.
I agree. So I'm going back. I started by telling you a story from running for Congress. I'm going to end by telling you a story because in a lot of ways it feels very similar to the moment we're at. And that is that there is time to perhaps replace him. And you're right, it will not be an Elizabeth Warren. It will not be a Bernie. It might, however, be an Amy Klobuchar, or it might be a Kamala Harris. And I think if they ended up deciding that it's not Joe, it will not be a male. It will be a female. And let me tell you why I almost know this for sure. Back in the late 1980s, I wrote the first ethics legislation in New Hampshire. And Bill, the Republican majority leader killed my bill and said that we were above reproach and gentlemen kept their own golf scores. His name was Vincent Palumbo. Vinny Palumbo, less than a year later, ends up doing a perp walk and going to jail. This is the Republican majority leader. When they were so desperate to clean the record, they were embarrassed about what he wrote on my ethics bill. Where did they go? They found a responsible, smart woman who happened to actually own the house I live in right now. And they met Carolyn Gross, the first female Republican majority leader in state history. And it was their way of their mea culpa. They also knew her, so she wasn't like a liberal Republican. She wasn't different in a lot of ways, maybe even politically from Vinny, but she clearly had a reputation that was squeaky clean and everybody could smile. And I just, looking at what's going on here now, Joe has not come forward. I actually was about to post on Facebook that I think there are two men that need to have a come to Jesus meeting with Joe Biden, maybe giving him guidance on what to say, or maybe giving him guidance on why to leave the stage. And that is Jim Clyburn and Barack Obama. They, more than any two human beings, I think are responsible for why we now have him as a nominee. And I think because they propped up, I think, the weakest of the candidates, they now have to help him figure out what the road is ahead. And I think that will be just incredibly interesting. And I think this might be how we get our first female nominee for president that might actually win, is because it turns out of an accusation against the current nominee.
Let me say, I don't have a preference on gender or race as strong as my preference for someone who's committed to the progressive changes we need.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think what you said is really smart, and it would be great if we can get both those things.
Yeah.
It would be great if we can get the committed progressive who also strikes a historic blow for diversity and women's rights and racial rights. It would be fabulous if we could do that. My first concern remains, you know, I want to know what they're for. Some of the women who ran,
I know.
I was less impressed with, but there are many out there. I would, you know, again, Elizabeth Warren, I'd be thrilled.
But it won't be her.
And there are others that I would be thrilled by. I also love what you said about Clyburn and Obama.
Mm-hmm.
Both the obligation they have,
yes,
and the extraordinary role that each played,
exactly,
in this, and their ability to deal with it. And, you know, if there's something true about this, that we have to figure out how to have a convention and have a new, you know, if this is not just something true, I don't mean, you know, if he just did something with a lot of sorts, if he did what she specifically has alleged in the second count, in the second allegation, then he should go.
Yeah.
And we have only a very few weeks to determine that. And his stonewalling, you know, he's never been good at explaining his votes.
I know.
You know, it's always a form of denial.
And I need to say
again,
goodbye.
Again, I don't want to. Is he worse than other politicians?
No.
Do I still see many other decent things of him?
Yes.
That I like, and do I still see him as a potential vehicle in the next 4 years for the aspirations of progressives in America and for the needs of the country? I do. But this must be dealt with, and it must be dealt with in an open, transparent, and forthright manner. And the point you've made that other people in the party, especially those two leaders, need to get out this very good point. You should make that point in as many places as you can.
Well, you write the piece for Salon.com. Again, Bill Curry, a two-time nominee for governor in Connecticut, an advisor to Bill Clinton, a writer at Salon.com, one of the most thoughtful people I know, and I needed to have this half hour so that you could sort of think out loud as we're trying to figure out what the H to do. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Thank you so much. We'll talk to you on Monday.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. You better-